House Committee on Consumer Protection for the Oregon Legislature. It is Wednesday, February 28th, and today we will be hearing four bills. House Bill 2751, 2755, Senate Bill 91, and House Bill 2113. And with that, I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2751. Steve, would you like to give us a brief preview of the bill before us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2751 permits insurer to issue liability insurance at preferred rate or premium to construction contractors without violating prohibitions against fictitious groupings.
Mr. Ario up first, please. Ario, excuse me.
A lot of people have known me for 20 years, still get it wrong, so, you know.
Okay, I'm working on it. 50-50 so far.
You could state your name correctly for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joel Ario. I'm the administrator with the Insurance Division with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, here today to testify in support of House Bill 2751. I'll don my Mark hat for a minute. Were he here, he would point out that this is a recommendation in the report of the task force, the Construction Contractors Task Force. It's one of the 11 recommendations in that report. And then he'd say, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Ario for the details. So now I'm into the details here. This bill, which we believe at this point is a consensus bill, deals with a specific situation for contractors, and the situation is where there is an opportunity to have a group policy rather than have a situation with a number of contractors and subcontractors working on a project together, all with their own policies. When you have the latter situation, you do have a lot more complexity because if something goes wrong, fingers point in all the different directions. You have more lawyers involved and more opportunity for litigation and more opportunity for a lot of transactional costs. So there is a market now, a desire in the marketplace for these group policies. The big group policies you may be familiar with are called wrap-ups. And the wrap-ups are used in things like the TriMet construction through the Southwest Hills, multi-billion-dollar projects, and they roll in not only all the contractors but also workers' comp. And there's a separate statute that deals with those projects, and it puts a $90 million limit on those kind of wraps that roll in workers' comp. We had discussion of whether we could have so-called mini wraps, smaller projects in the $90 million that also rolled in workers' comp, and in the end, the task force decided that didn't make sense because the complexity of the workers' comp part of the project really does call for it to be a large project before you have to start sorting out premium between this and other projects. But the task force did see a window here of opportunity for these mini wraps if they were group policies just for the contractors, so excluding workers' comp. So everybody comes in with their own workers' comp coverage, but for the contractor piece, there could be a specific policy written for that would be specific to that project. And we're talking, I think, in practical terms, probably about mostly condominium type projects or other multi-family type projects. And they are going on in the marketplace today, but they're primarily, or if not exclusively, going on in the surplus lines marketplace, which is the unregulated part of the market for people who can't find insurance in the regulated market. And the reason for that is that those kinds of group projects run afoul of some of the laws that generally are applicable to group projects on the property and casualty side. Those laws all have to do with trying to make sure that group projects like this aren't done in a way that's unfair to the rest of the property and casualty market. So there are some hoops to jump through, and people just haven't found it worthwhile to have to jump through all those hoops. What we propose here is a streamlining process that would allow group contractor projects to not have to go work through those regulatory hoops and be approved on a streamlined basis in the admitted market the same way they are today in the surplus lines market, so that all insurers could compete equally for that kind of work. And the mechanism for doing that is to make an exception in the what's called a fictitious group law, which is 737-600. And so this bill, if you look at it, the operative language in the bill is on page 2, and it just creates a new exception to the fictitious group laws for, quote, liability insurance required for contractors under ORS 701-105. That's the CCB statute that requires contractor liability. So that's the mechanism for doing this. And you'll see there are a number of other exceptions like this for daycare facilities where there are multiple insurance policies. To have a group policy so you don't have all this finger-pointing among the parties is kind of the idea to save transaction costs. One last thing, and then I'd be happy to answer questions. We thought the language that everybody seemed to be okay with for a while, as people have gotten closer to the hearing and looked at it, they said, you know, this specific language doesn't really capture the concept, right, because we're not really talking about the liability insurance that's required for contractors. We're talking about a different kind of insurance that's an exception or a substitute for that usual insurance. So I'm offering today an amendment that would simply tweak the words a little bit, and instead of saying what it currently says, it would say liability insurance for contractors licensed under ORS Chapter 701, and that would make it clear that we're not talking about the specific type of insurance that's required. We're talking about a form of contractor's insurance that's different than that. And I believe this amendment is acceptable to all the parties, and I believe you're getting copies of it right now. So we would propose that amendment offered to the committee for its consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that anybody has.
Questions from the committee? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ariel, thank you for being here again today. I just wanted to pick up on something you said that I didn't quite understand. You said these contractors weren't required to have workers' comp or couldn't participate in a group for workers' comp.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I probably misspoke there. What I was trying to say is that there are large wrap projects that you may have heard about under a different statute that not only pulled in contractor work but also workers' compensation. So you have the whole package together. And under current law, those projects have to be at least a $90 million minimum. What we're talking about here is a different concept, which is projects that don't meet that standard and would not include workers' comp, but would be group liability policies. That's what this bill focuses on.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Olney. I have a question with just the phrase fictitious grouping. Is this a new phrase that we're introducing to statute, or is that something that's existed before?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, no, it's a common phrase in the property and casualty industry, and you probably don't want to get into the details of this, but what it essentially refers to is, take a simple example, like we'll say with auto insurance, you wouldn't want a carrier to be able to create an artificial group of, say, people who live in X neighborhood and charge them a cheaper rate than you charged everybody else that lived in surrounding areas, because it would typically those things were done in the olden days in a way that was racially discriminatory or otherwise discriminatory against certain types of groups. So the law grew up around the concept that in property and casualty you can't group people in a, quote, fictitious way without rationale for why that group deserves a break. And then there's a lot of law around making sure that the groups actually can justify those breaks. And so that's the origin of this law. And what we do here is simply say for these kind of projects, that's not a concern, and so we're accepting them from those standards.
Thank you. Further questions? So this fictitious grouping was in statute before. Obviously, it's not anything we're adding at this point. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There's a general standard that if you want to form a group in the property and casualty side, you have to show that the group really has material benefits and that they deserve lower rates. And so that's the concept of fictitious groups, so-called, have to meet standards, and we're just accepting this group from a pre-existing statute.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Ariel.
Thank you.
Yeah, but I'm sure if anybody else wants to testify.
Seems more steamy for this part. Is there any other testimony on House Bill 2751? If not, I'll close the public hearing on 2751 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2755. Mr. Administrator, would you tell us what this is? Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2755 requires Construction Contractor Board and DCBS to develop a manual containing information on the subject of moisture intrusion and water damage in residential structures.
Thank you. And could I ask you, is this part of the is this a bill that's in part of the contractors group?
No, Madam Chair, this is not part of the Construction Claims Task Force package of bills.
Thank you so much. All right, coming to testify, I have Amanda Rich, please. And if Mr. Cafori be ready, followed by Andrea Simmons and then Craig Smith, and we'll get right through this. Get to the what I call the actual factual contractual points of this bill.
Good afternoon, Madam Vice Chair and members of the committee. My name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here today on behalf of Contractors Bonding and Insurance Company. We asked that this bill be introduced because, well, we absolutely believe that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and that's what this bill is about. There's a little bit of background. CBIC bonds about 25% of the contractors in Oregon, insures about 10%, is the number one underwriter of surety bonds in the Northwest. And the company is dedicated to educating their bondholders and insureds about loss prevention. One of our chief loss prevention officer, in fact, does a weekly column in CBIC's e-newsletter about risks and reducing risks. And just recently, the company compiled those columns, shall we say, or those weekly write-ups into a book that you have before you called Think Safety. And also, we've got these little magnets here that they send out all the time with their billings to their contractors, and they say, you know, a little caution can prevent an accident. It's that one extra little turn of the screw that might provide the quality that's going to prevent, that's going to help with risk and prevent an accident. And I provide these to you simply to give you some context of where we're coming from on this bill. The task force, when they undertook to study the issue of claims, it became immediately clear that the major cause of the increase in insurance and of the issue that the task force was looking at was moisture intrusion and claims on moisture intrusion. It's all about litigation about mold. And CBIC, in fact, looked back at their claims on their insurance policies and found that 80% of them had the word water, mold, moisture in them somewhere. And so as the task force was going along and discussing these issues and coming up with their package, they put forward bills that look at reducing the risk on the front end in terms of educating the contractor. You've talked about certification bills, and you've talked about bills to kind of tighten up the entry into the process. We've also looked at issues on the back end regarding insurance and regarding trying to kind of clean up the mess when it's done. But it occurred to us that one piece of the equation that's missing is the issue of the homeowner. If you knew that the most likely claim that you might have to make about damage to your home, to a brand new home, dealt with moisture intrusion, you might want to know at the front end how to help prevent moisture intrusion, how to address it when you see it. Frankly, these claims are a lot less expensive if they're caught a lot earlier. And we felt like the homeowner needed to be educated about how to care for their home to prevent these issues. Again, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And that's really what this bill is about.
Amanda, pardon me for interrupting. Do you have written testimony?
I do not, but I would be happy to write it up and give it to you.
You gave us some good facts and figures, and I was trying, but I didn't get them all down.
Sorry, just rattling them off.
That's okay.
We've been living with these issues for a while now, so.
That's okay. Is this a how to build without getting moisture book?
This is a how to take care of your new home to recognize the signs of moisture intrusion and to prevent moisture intrusion.
For homeowners.
For homeowners. This is
consumers.
This is for consumers, yes, ma'am. This is a bill that says when you buy a new house that the person that you buy it from is going to hand you a book that says this is how you take care of your house relative to moisture intrusion. We're not talking about the entire scope of things, but and again, this may not be the perfect solution. We have talked to we talked to both agencies that are affected by this bill, Building Codes Division and the CCB, and they have concerns about what's our role in this, who writes what, and they have concerns about cost and the cost of producing the book. But really what we're talking about here is that we feel that homeowner education about moisture intrusion and about preventing it and catching it early if it does happen needs to be part of this equation and part of this overall solution that we are fashioning here through this process.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Thank you, Ms. Rich, for being here. And when I first looked at this bill, I thought, what a great idea. Is this something that we need to put in statute? And I wondered, you addressed already that you talked with the agencies, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the conversations among the interested groups in the industry about a way to address this without passing a law directing that the manual be written. I'm not saying it's a bad idea. It just doesn't strike me as something that should be in statute.
Madam Vice Chair and Madam Vice Chair.
Hey, that's cool.
We have not had a direct conversations, for example, with the home building industry. I do know, however, that many home builders do provide a manual to their new homeowners, and it's kind of a practice that they put into place, a value-added add-on maybe, or just they believe it's good practice to make sure that homeowners know how to take care of that home, and they're covering their risk a little bit in that. And it may be that we don't need legislation to do this, and that we just simply need to encourage further education of homeowners. But we felt it was important enough to bring it before you to talk about the issue.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, Representative Gerard.
Following up on Representative Bonamici's comment, I was just kind of curious, basically kind of to reiterate what she was saying, is if we really want to put this into statute, and I don't see an enforcement mechanism in this bill either, so it just appears to me that maybe we'd be better just to educate the home builders that's a prudent thing to do.
Madam Vice Chair, Representative Gerard, absolutely. I think that further education about best practices is going to take us a long way. And I certainly wouldn't anticipate in any way penalizing, if this were to pass, penalizing a contractor for failure to provide a manual. We saw it more as encouraging the education process.
Thank you. Amanda, in my first term, way back when, I had so many calls from individuals who had mold. I mean, I had mothers with children, in fact, who had moved to Salem. They were so allergic to this, but that was their home. They put their money in it. You know, really sad stories. And these were sold, you know, by realtors, not first-time, homeowners. Or the builder, I guess. Not the builder's responsibility. Well, I don't know whose responsibility. But I think this is a great idea. I think if a group could come together, and thank you for this book. It's really nice. Mm-hmm. And I hate to suggest that the insurance companies do that, because I know up go the rates. But I agree with Representative Bonamici and Representative Girard. Maybe there's another way to tackle this, and I'm certainly concerned about mandates, and this is one. Mm-hmm. Lord knows business doesn't need any more mandates, do they?
No, no, ma'am, and absolutely, Madam Vice Chair. Any way we can be a part of the process to help out, we'd love to do it.
Okay, thank you. Oh. Representative Gillian wants to make a late comment.
No, I'll follow up here and then I will.
Okay, well, Representative Girard to speak for Girard.
Well, thank you. I have a question as to what is the value of this?
I knew that was going to come up.
$9.99, isn't it?
Now, and means of full disclosure, it is worth over $10. So if
we have
if
to give
vision
back.
A testimony, if providing it through testimony, it makes it not a gift, then, you know, then that's a decision, I suppose, that we'd have to maybe talk to the chief clerk about. But
Representative, you can pass the books,
if
please.
If you can pass the books back and give them back, that's fine. I did make them available to the public. I brought as many as I could carry.
All right. Thank you very much for being here. And we'll give these. Oh, wait a minute. Representative Gilliam.
Oh, yes.
He was late to the meeting. We usually don't allow people who are late to have an opportunity to question, but today we're going to make an exception.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. I just wanted to comment that I too wonder of the appropriateness for statute, but having been a homeowner mm-hmm. with water intrusion and all, and then having been a freshman legislator sitting on this panel and being drilled about the envelope, my suggestion, there are two suggestions that I have. One is the possibility of realtors, so that it wouldn't be sponsored by a particular company, a board of realtors, an MLS, with their promotions, might be very excited about being a partner on this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And my other suggestion would be to make the manual in the shape of a house and have the manual go in a moisture-proof envelope. I actually think that would be it. And I think new homeowners would love to have that. So that's my suggestion.
That is a brilliant
one. Worth $20. You'll never be able to see it.
All right. Let's move on, and thank you for being here, Amanda.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'd like to move to Mr. Kafori, if you will, please. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Stephen Gafore, here representing the Oregon Remodelers Association today. The Oregon Remodelers Association was instrumental in getting the Construction Contractors Board established in the first place. We've always been very much concerned about consumer protection, but we're also concerned about consumer responsibility. And it seems that we're always coming down here to the legislature, and the legislature is seeing more burden and more burden and more burden on the industry to protect the consumer, and we think that the consumer ought to have a little bit of responsibility to take care of their own property. That being said, a lot of times people don't have any information about how to take care of their own property. And I attended the task force meetings, and I was really struck by, I thought I knew something about this issue, and I found that I didn't. It's a lot of brand new information about water intrusion and how to protect your home against it. And there are a lot of other issues as well. The only thing, two things I would have comment about this bill, and one is that, besides the fact that obviously that maybe we could do it without a bill, is that it focuses just on one issue. And there are other issues besides water intrusion that are necessary for homeowners to be involved with in terms of protection of their house, besides just taking care that the water intrusion doesn't happen. There's other kinds of maintenance that is required of a homeowner, and we think that people, if you're going to produce something like this, that people ought to be warned and advised about other kinds of protections besides just against water intrusion. We also want to make sure that used homes, which are remodeled, are also included, not just new homes. A lot of work, we were talking the other day at our meeting about how many remodelers are involved one way or another way in the envelope, and a lot of people you wouldn't think of, for example, painters. You don't obviously think about a painter is going to have anything to do with the building envelope, and yet they do an awful lot because they're covering up things in the windows.
Hey, only way to cover that mold up, I
know.
Yeah.
And we were discussing the bill that we had heard here earlier about requiring training for people who touch the envelope anyway, and it's a huge percentage of our folks, and therefore it's going to be a huge percentage of all remodeled homes as well as new homes. We do suggest that if there's some way to do this by talking to the agencies, I think that that could be done without having to pass a statute. And I also would request that you not put additional burdens on the contractors to mandate that they give these. We already have lots and lots of stuff that we give to new people. And every request of the people that produce this to make it simple. I just moved into a condominium a couple of years ago, and I got a book about 2 inches thick about how to take care of my unit. And, yeah, of course, that goes on the shelf and never gets looked at. If you produce a booklet or a pamphlet that's small and in simple language, it's a lot more useful. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Cafori. I'll call on Andrea Simmons now from the Building Codes Division.
Madam Chair, is permissible if Craig Smith from CCB joins me at the table?
I think you have a priority.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrea Simmons. I'm a manager over at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today before you to address some concerns with the way the bill is drafted now. You've heard quite a few of the concerns, and Representative Gerard pointed out another concern that we have. The bill as drafted puts two agencies working together in concert together to produce a manual. That's not necessarily the problem, but as you come to enforcement and who's responsible at the tail end, there's some unclear provisions in this bill that could be clarified better, especially if you're looking at a very quick date to get this effective, which is January 1st of 2008. That's real quick for two agencies to work together to develop a manual and then get it ready to publish it out on the streets on January 1st of 2008. The other piece, as pointed out by Representative Gerard, the department has some concerns about an enforcement mechanism as to what happens when the seller doesn't provide this manual to someone who may purchase a home. To let you know that this concept was briefly discussed, at least, with the Construction Claims Task Force. It was discussed at one particular point in time, and early during the summer, it was decided, it was tabled, it was not moved forward as one of the recommendations, so it's not contained in the report that we've been discussing a number of legislative concepts with you, but it was tabled with a vote of 9-0. It was unclear, I went to look today to see why, and it was unclear as to why it was tabled. I just wanted to kind of address that, answer any questions you may have.
Thank you so much. Andrea, questions? Okay, thank you for being here. And Mr. Smith, welcome. What a surprise to see you here.
Chair, Vice Chair Nelson and members of the committee, Craig Smith for the Construction Contractors Board. Thank you for allowing me to come up and tag team with Andrea. We've briefly looked at this bill and talked a little bit with the sponsor, and of course it's a grand idea to get information to consumers. Can't argue with that. That's vital. Question, as you've already brought up, might be, do you want to do this in statute? Do you want to do this some other way? Is there a market-based solution that might work? We appreciate working with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. As Andrea has pointed out, there are some issues here. If you choose to go further with this bill, we'd be extremely happy to work with stakeholders and our partner agencies to try to work with amendments to bring this into a workable product for you. Be happy to answer questions.
Questions? I guess not. Thank you. Is there anyone else here to speak on House Bill 2755? If not, I'm going to... Oh, please come forward, sir. How come you didn't sign in?
I did sign in.
Where is he on here? Mr. Administrator, we have that invisible ink again. I'm just kidding. Oh, Harlan, here you are, down at the very bottom. You wanted to be last, right?
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, for the record, I am Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I had another committee hearing down the hall that I needed to be at, too, so I wasn't sure I could be at both of them at the same time.
We're glad you came.
So I put my name down at the bottom. Again, Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. We don't have a position on this bill, but just wanted to point out one thing. if the committee decides to move forward with this bill, we would ask that there be an amendment to state that if a seller of a new residential property were not to give the required manual, we would not want that to be cause for a buyer to rescind the contract. This bill is unclear as to what the remedy would be for failure to give that manual, and you heard about that in some previous testimony. There is precedent for this. If you look at the statute that requires sellers of homes with wells to have the well tested for nitrates, they need to provide a copy of those results to the Department of Human Services, and failure to do so is specifically called out in the statute as not giving the buyer a right to rescind. We just want to make sure that that is clear in this statute as well, should you decide to pursue this and move forward. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you for being here. Questions? If not, we save the best to last.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. And I'm going to close the public hearing now on House Bill 2755 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 91. A little bit out of order, but I'm obeying the chair. Do we have anyone? Do you already have a question?
There you go.
I'm waiting for her to get this good list up here. Okay, well, Abby, it's Craig Smith. Would you come forward? Craig, I've got to compliment you to keep your demeanor so calm, cool, and collected. Hope you don't have ulcers. You are so responsive. Reminds me of one of the men that came to the veterans every day, but it got him promoted to a general, so that was General Caldwell, so maybe it'll work.
That's a wonderful compliment. Thank you very much.
Representative Bonamici, I think, wants to say something.
Madam Vice Chair, would it be helpful for our committee administrator to give us a summary of the bill, please, before Mr. Smith?
I think that is a good idea, and I'm sorry I forgot that.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair and Vice Chair. Senate Bill 91 requires construction contractor to immediately notify the Construction Contractors Board of changes in identity, name, or address of partners, joint venturers, owners, officers, managers, members, trustees, or other persons controlling contractor, and of responsible managing individuals for contractor.
Thank you. Yeah, Mr. Smith.
Vice Chair Nelson and members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm with the Construction Contractors Board, and again, I want to acknowledge the kind words of the Vice Chair. This is a fairly simple bill. It's really just an expansion of current law, though it looks like it's more of a broadening than that. Today, not individuals as much as corporations that have changes in corporate officers need to tell the Construction Contractors Board when they do that. And the reason for that is that in some cases those individuals have been responsible for construction debts or other problems that remain unpaid. And knowing who belongs to each company is a benefit to our ability to be able to hold individuals that have been responsible for problems in the past from operating, frankly, in current businesses. This expands that, particularly brings it into the modern-day province of limited liability companies. That's the biggest problem we have right now, is limited liability companies don't need to do that. And if I can take just a moment of your time, I'll tell you that we had a situation recently where a licensee, a limited liability company, brand new fella, was doing a good job, and was doing a very, very good job for 2 years. He unfortunately teamed up with a couple of actors who had less than solid pass, folks that we had driven out of the business. Frankly, what happened was the whole business went to, it went badly. And it resulted in about 12 different claims with the Construction Contractors Board, thousands, tens of thousands of debts for consumers. And I blame it partly on the individual who brought his partners in, but we would have been able to stop that had there been this requirement and had the contractor complied with it. So we could have advised that individual that that simply was a couple of partners that he couldn't bring into the business. So we ask your favorable consideration of Senate Bill 91. and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. And Craig, I'm assuming this was part of the task force?
Representative Nelson, I can tell you this was not, but this concept of having problems of people going in and out of business was discussed. That's not really a construction defect, so they didn't deal with it.
I see.
Consumers complained about it in loud fashion at the task force meetings.
Thank you. Any questions? I'm just wondering, surely we're going to find that we've omitted some type of private business. I don't know why it just doesn't say private and public, all private and public business relationships or something, because there's surely going to be something here that we didn't catch. I guess it's better than nothing.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Mr. Spitz, does this bill expand the information that needs to be reported as well as expanding the entities that need to report the information?
Madam Vice Chair and Representative Bonamici, no, that was not our intent with the bill. I don't believe that's what it does. I think it just expands the individuals in the business that need to be reported.
Thank you.
And Craig, could you help me really quickly find out if they don't do this, what happens to them?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that would be a violation of the statute, 701, of course, and in 701-990, we have the ability to issue civil penalties for failure. Civil penalties for this kind of a failure would not be terribly high, but you've authorized civil penalties as high as $5,000.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay. We thank you for being here. Are there any others in the audience who would like to testify? Thank you. I'll now close that, if I haven't already. If I have, it's two times, and that means it was a good bill. I'll give it my approval. Okay, we'll now go to House Bill 2113. Mr. Administrator, tell us what it is, please.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. House Bill 2113 allows property owner to obtain disallowance of supplier lien for materials, equipment, labor, or services if the owner has already paid original contractor for materials, equipment, labor, or services that are the basis of the lien.
Thank you.
Open a public hearing.
Okay, I'm going to open this public hearing on House Bill 2113. Mr. Cafori.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Cafori, representing the Oregon Remodeling Association. This bill has been around the legislature in one form or another ever since I can remember. Everybody agrees it's a good thing, but
nobody does
it's, when push comes to shove, I won't try that, I sound like George Bush.
That's okay, go right ahead.
Somebody's ox gets bored. And so it never passes. We suggest that it might not be a good thing for the bill to pass and for homeowners to be protected in a pay-twice situation. It doesn't happen very often. It doesn't have to happen very often. Once or twice, a biennium is plenty enough for people to come to the legislature and say, why didn't the legislature take care of this problem? Why should I, after having paid for the contractor for fixing my house, why should I have to double pay the lien holders? Subs who provide services or materials, and we agree with that, and we would suggest you pass the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Cafori. Are there any questions from this?
I'll go ahead and take back control. Thank you.
Good. Okay.
Thank you, Vice Chair Nelson.
Yes.
since I have the gavel back in my hand, Mr. Kifori, does the committee have questions? Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair. We've heard several more bills to this, and what's been brought to my attention is that sometimes in certain circumstances, the homeowner doesn't have is in close proximity to the initial contractor, the brother, the spouse, or whatever, and that would also go for the contractor and the sub. What I'm saying is that if we were to pass this bill, for example, and say that the contractor had a load of lumber taken to the house, then that would not allow them to collect on that lumber, even though there's not an arm's length difference between the contractor and the homeowner. So it sounds good in theory, but it's not something that's easy to deal with. Do you have any input onto that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, let me see if I can understand the situation.
A general contractor that would not be an arm's length with the homeowner.
Okay.
So the say that the contractor is the brother of the homeowner, okay. And then they go to the sub, being the person, the people that deliver the wood for the house, for example. And so the contractor just says, then throws his hands up in the air and says, well, she paid me, but I'm going bankrupt or do whatever, and the sub doesn't have the option to come back on the homeowner. So it's one of those scenarios where two bad apples, either way you do it, fouls somebody over. And so I've kind of toyed with how to write a bill for this one, but it's difficult in concept for me to come up with.
Mr. Representative Gerard, I think you're going to hear exactly that testimony from someone else saying that this problem has occurred. I have not seen it or heard of that circumstance, and I guess it seems to me that as long as a homeowner has paid once, that the homeowner ought not to have to pay a second time. And if there's a collusion and it's illegal, then you've got some other cause of action. But that one baffles me, frankly. I don't know that it would happen. It might be conjecturally, but I don't know that in the real world that's a problem.
Further questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kifori, do you think this was part of the contractor's task force proposal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm trying to recollect. There were so many issues that came in front of that group, and they talked about them and voted on them a number of times and then selected down and then did it again. I can't remember where this one came from that group, and it certainly was discussed there.
Thank you. Further questions? I just assume from your sign-up sheet that you're in favor of this bill. Your position is for the passage of this bill?
Mr. Chair, the Oregon Remodeler Association Government Affairs Committee, which has the authority to speak on behalf of the Remodeler Association, take a vote in favor of the bill.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if we might get the Construction Contractors Board to come forward, which should have happened first, maybe.
Chair Holby and members of the committee, Craig Smith with the Construction Contractors Board. This is a Construction Contractors Board bill. It's one that we had pre-session filed, and we filed it for a couple of reasons. I think I testified before you a couple of weeks ago, and you heard some testimony from a consumer who had suffered as a result of the current law the way it is. This is a problematic law. It's written the way it is. As I testified before, in this state, much the way it is in some other states, but it nevertheless creates a terrible problem for consumers. And that's one of the reasons we bring this to you, is that a full 1 to 2% of the complaints that we handle against contractors are this very issue. And that's where a consumer, if I can, I'll just tell the story of one happened in around the McMinnville area, where a homeowner contracted to have a very expensive home built. The project went south. Everything again went poorly and resulted in, from the consumer standpoint, a pay twice situation of $60,000. That person filed in arbitration. He prevailed in arbitration, but obviously that's higher than anything that this board can handle. And although the contractors board has effectively removed that contractor from working in Oregon, this homeowner, his position is that he has paid over $60,000 twice for the same goods and services. The Construction Contractors Board is currently seeking to penalize that contractor for that pay twice problem. But it occurs to us at the Construction Contractors Board, and we bring it to you for your consideration, that that's bad public policy. We think that it's wrong. We think that this is an issue about who ought to bear the risk. And we think that a good argument can be made that the supplier who supplies goods and services to a sub or general should have the risk of who they're selling the product to. And if that person goes out of business, that was their business decision to sell that product to the contractor. If indeed the consumer has paid the contractor in full, shouldn't they be done? And we think that they should, and we sure would appreciate your support.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Girard.
Following the same line of questioning, would you support an amendment that said basically to the effect that the contractor and the homeowner, for this to take effect, would have to be at I don't know, what's the legal term, arm's length?
Chair Holby and Representative Girard, we would appreciate any kind of consideration you give to this problem. I'd have to study that further and be able to give you good feedback on it. I think as I recall, I want to make sure you recall my testimony that this is something that Speaker Merkley 4 years ago, 6 years ago, I think, actually, tackled. It's been tackled over the last 20 years, 25 years, and I think that anything more that we can do to protect consumers, if that's the solution, we'd be happy to help you with that.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, you know, the story from that I really appreciate regarding McGilva, who owes many people about $700,000. I don't know, with interest, it's a lot more than that right now. But as a consumer, what am I supposed to do now? I am supposed to keep all my bills from the contractor and a copy of the checks, staple them together, and when somebody comes after me, I give this to them and they're going to say, good? I don't think so. Unless the law is somewhere, I don't know where it is.
Yeah. Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, I can tell you that the way the law is now is that we require a general contractor to provide a notice to the homeowner. And what the notice says is that you're doing business with me, but in essence, you're doing business with every person that I contract with as well. And you may be at risk, even if you pay me in full. Now, this notice isn't always given. There's penalties if it's not given, sadly. And I know this is, you know, some of this has to be on consumers. But sadly, it's probably rarely even read, even though it's required to be given. And the argument that the Construction Contractors Board brings you today is that rather than advise consumers that the law could be very tough on them, we think that once they pay, that ought to be it. And we think, frankly, the market would operate better. The market would operate better to reduce people who aren't creditworthy from being able to borrow and get those material suppliers or subs to work for them if indeed the suppliers or subs didn't have access to lien the property if the consumer has already paid.
One special question. Thank you. Mr. Chair, this happened to me one time. But I learned this lesson where I put paid to Tom Purvis and Lumberman's and the amount when they gave me a bill for materials. Isn't that some way that a homeowner could protect themselves?
Chair Halvey and Representative Nelson, if I'm tracking with your question again, we do list several things on this notice as to how consumers can protect themselves, and one of the ways is to, when they choose to pay the general contractor, pay the general contractor by not a two-party check, but a check that's made out to two payees.
Okay.
Representative Riley.
Very quickly, if I may, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that, I understand that that's a great way to possibly protect yourself, but as we all know, one of the reasons we hire general contractors is because we have jobs to go to, we have other things we have to do, and that we see, the public, see those general contractors as the person who's responsible to get the work done, however it needs to be done. And very few people will even know who the subs or the suppliers are.
That's right. That's true.
In closing, if I could tell you that there, I want you to know that contractors have been proactive, that they have worked to try to minimize the risk to home buyers, particularly in new home construction. But it doesn't work all the time, and again, from our perspective, we think this has some merit that you should consider.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Greg, before you get up, I think I've got a question. Do we have numbers? I'm trying to remember if I've received any numbers about how many. What kind of dollar amount are we talking about in consumers that have been left holding the bag, so to speak, I guess, for in this pay-twice situation based on, you know, the lien,
yeah,
liens being attached to their property?
Chair Halvey, it's a great question. We don't have great numbers on that. I can tell you that we receive about 1,000 complaints a year from homeowners against construction contractors, the 43,000 licensed contractors, and I can tell you that about 1 to 2% of those complaints are what we call lien complaints or lien claims. Sadly, we obviously don't get most of the complaints, and in many cases, consumers, we get letters, and this is the reason we know this, and I think common sense dictates it as well. We know that in many cases, once that consumer gets that notice, that lien notice, they panic and they write the check because they worry that they're going to get a cloud on their title. And of course then they come to the construction contractors board and ask, how can this be? And that's one of the reasons we come to you today.
And one other item I was curious about, the construction contractors board is a panel made up of the industry, and they voted to support this bill, and can you reveal, I don't know whether it's appropriate to reveal, it should be, what that vote was to support this?
Oh, well, it, yes, I can, Chair Halvey and members of the committee. The Construction Contractors Board is made up of both industry and non-industry, 6 industry members and 3 individuals who aren't necessarily associated with industry. And as I recall, all of our legislative concepts, including this one, was a unanimous support of the entire board.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, another question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Why don't we just make this a criminal action?
Right.
I mean, and go forth. I am really mad at McGilva. I mean, and we don't even require these contractors to take, you know, restitution. And, I mean, people like this and the one you talked about in my county, have we thought about doing that?
No.
I ought to put them away so they can't keep working.
Right. Chair Halvey and Representative Nelson, I can tell you that when possible, we look at this as theft. There has to be intent. There's got to be some issues there. And we are successful sometimes. But in many cases, the contractor is going belly up. It isn't an intentional act. They didn't mean to do it. Very difficult to prove theft in that case. But again, it comes back to just because the contractor went out of business, why should the consumer suffer? That's where we're coming from.
Thank you. Further questions? Seeing none at this time, thank you, Craig, for your testimony today. I see no one else signed up to testify on House Bill 2113. Is there anybody left in the audience that would like to just weigh in once again? Oh, I see something. Somebody in the back.
Waving,
yes. Come forward, please.
Good afternoon. Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association. And I wasn't planning on testifying on this bill today, but I just did want to clarify one thing, and that is, as Craig Smith from the Contractors Board mentioned, about 3 years ago, we addressed this issue, and we took care of it for remodels over $50,000, and we also took care of it for all brand-new home constructions, except those where you have a custom home being built on the particular owner's property. In other words, the home builder doesn't own the property. The consumer owns the property and hires a builder to come out and do it. Then that builder also goes bankrupt. That's where this comes into play. And so I just wanted to clarify again, for new subdivisions and most of the homes we sell, there is a provision that requires the builder to provide protection to the homeowner. And generally that entails what's called early issue title insurance, and the banks have had it for years. It simply protects the banks and now the consumer as well from that 75-day period where the subcontractor or material supplier would have an opportunity to lien the job site and to what they call perfect their lien. And so that early issue title insurance now would pay off instead of the homeowner were that lien to be perfected after you had somebody go out of business with a newly constructed home, again, as long as it wasn't a custom home. So I hope that clarifies a little bit with regard to new construction subdivisions where you've got a developer builder building the home site and then selling the home once it's completed.
Thank you. Questions?
So you're taking a position on this bill?
I think Chair Holby, Representative Galizio, we have some interest in working on the bill to make sure it doesn't go back from where we from the point we've reached with Speaker Merkley. We spent, I think it was the 2003 session on the bill, and then the 2004 special session kind of fixing a problem that existed. So I think it made real estate sales illegal, so we had to fix that one little portion. But we did take care of that, and so there is a good system in place today allowing for that early issue title insurance to cover the homeowner for that period of time, no more than 75 days. That's all a subcontractor or supplier would have to perfect that lien.
Follow up, please, Representative Galizio.
But the early issue title insurance, you talk about for new subdivisions, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars. I mean, for a single homeowner, would it be typical that there would be this available to, you know?
Chair Holby, Representative Galizio, it's actually on each individual home that the builder would have to supply one of, I think there's six different options that they can offer. The early issue is the most common because the title insurance companies simply give that to the builder as a protection against the concerns we've heard about today. So that consumer automatically gets that early issue title insurance, or the builder, I think, can put up a large bond, or they can have some money held in a bank account, but it really comes down to the early issue title insurance that's offered by the title insurance companies on each individual house, so that if the house is finished on the 30th of January and it's sold 30 days later, the only opportunity for that lien to be perfected is one where the normal title insurance did not pick it up because the 75 days had not elapsed on maybe some of the last contractors on the job site. or the last material supplier, because everyone else's 75 days would have run out. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If this is not taken out, if none of these remedies are done, is there anything in law that keeps the consumer from having to pay twice, even on those developments? I mean, you say we put it in law that they have to do this. What if they don't?
No. Chair Holby, Representative Riley, I'm not sure what the penalty is. It was about 3 years ago, and we spent some time, I know, talking about that issue with Representative Merkley when the bill passed. I think a scenario under which it wouldn't occur, given that it's offered free to the contractor to supply to the homeowner, and even in a custom home situation, they still have to select one of those six options to supply protection to the homeowner. And I understand your question is, what if they don't, even though the requirement is there? And I don't remember what the penalty was off the top of my head.
Follow up, please. Thank you. And in the other situations where they choose one of the other options, and they go out of business and we find it's not enough to cover the liens that come up, the homeowner is going to be paying twice still. Is that correct?
Chair Holby, Representative Riley, I know of no instance, and Craig Smith can probably answer better than I am, whether that's ever occurred.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you, Scott. Jessica?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. As it relates to House Bill 2113 and its applicability on the residential side, we would concur that making sure that this doesn't trip over the good reforms that we made, and I believe it was the 01 session and the changes in the 02 special session. I think we would support making sure that we certainly don't go backwards, that to the extent we move forward this bill, it goes forwards and adds appropriate additional protections there. On the commercial side, however, the process is different in contract law. Requires the general contractor to essentially absorb that risk. So only to the extent that the general contractor has issues, in which case owners are protected by bonds and insurance. If a supplier or a subcontractor leans against the project, it becomes the general contractor's problem, not the owner's problem by contract and by how commercial lien law is set up. Our problem, as we've expressed before, is the fact that we don't know who the equipment dealers are on those projects. Material suppliers are required to give notice of right to lien. Equipment dealers are not. Those notices of right to lien go to the owner. They don't go to the general contractor. So we may not know who our second-tier or third-tier subs equipment dealers are. You get a lot of orange equipment on a site. You don't necessarily know whose it is. 70 days after the job is over, we get a notice saying, you owe us a whole bunch of money that we've already paid. And so our issue is knowing who those folks are. A simple notice of right to lien that's sent to the general contractor would make a big difference. It would help make sure that payments happen quickly and efficiently. It allows the industry to police itself. It would solve a whole lot of problems. And so we would be very happy to participate in a work group on this bill and see if we can't make those changes that we believe on the commercial side would make things better for our clients, our owners, and the commercial industry in general.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Jessica and Scott. I want to make sure I understand, because both of you said something about not going back and undoing what we've done before with prior law. And I just want to make sure that what this bill does and what you see this bill doing is providing the same protections to to transactions that aren't new home construction, that aren't covered by the early issue title insurance. Is that correct? Or do you see this bill replacing the protections for so that the early issue title insurance will not have to apply because there won't be a pay twice provision if this passes in its current state?
Chair Hovey, Representative Bonamici, I believe this may replace that, and I'd have to take a look at the bill again to confirm that. I think in its current form, though, and they are not here today, I think that there will be quite a bit of concern as this bill starts to move from the suppliers and the subcontractors, and so trying to find that balance is, I think, what we're after with the work group.
I just want to make sure I understood that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, the attorneys that I've spoken to on this bill do have that concern that this may indeed replace those protections. And I think for the most part, those have gone a long way in starting to address some of these issues on those large condo, or not large condominium, but the large developments where really in the 90s we started to see these problems appear, where you would have a developer that disappeared and the homeowners were left with some of these claims. So I think that from the perspective of trying to get at where the bulk of these occurred, I think that at least in that arena, many of those reforms got us most of the way there. We're not saying that there isn't room to do more. And so AGC is not, from the residential side, we aren't saying that this isn't perhaps something to look at. But from our perspective on the commercial side, we're hoping to look at something that will provide better protections for everyone. On the notice issue.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? So let me ask Jessica a question here. You had mentioned a couple of times about the difference in contract law in the commercial industry as opposed to the residential industry a couple of times. And if I'm not mistaken, this bill appears to affect both commercial and residential in its form. So what kind of law specifically are you talking just about, you know, that the commercial industry has contracts that are different than the contracts that home builders use, or are you actually talking there's a different statute law for commercial construction as opposed to residential that gives the commercial industry some sort of buffer from this scenario?
Chair Holvey, the commercial industry, the contracts that are created, as I understand it from my attorney friends, those contracts transfer the liability for liens to the general contractor, which is a bit different than in the residential situation. And there are differences in the lien law between how commercial liens work and how residential liens work. There are more protections for residential folks than there are for commercial. And again, there is liability that gets transferred onto the commercial contractor that I don't believe happens as much in the residential industry. So there are a variety of differences, some of them subtle, and I am not an attorney that practices in lien law every day, and so I'm going to be very careful not to overstep here, but there, as I understand it, there are significant differences between the residential and the commercial that create more liability on a commercial general contractor. And again, it's not knowing who's on our job site that creates a real problem when we end up right at the 11th hour finding out that someone didn't get paid after the job's over and retainage has been released.
Thank you. And for Mr. Berry, I previously heard testimony of scenarios where the supplier or subcontractor would knowingly contract to do business with a general that they had knowledge that was in deep financial trouble and was probably not going to pay the bills, but are still willing to supply that work and those supplies knowing that they were protected by this lien law and so could, in effect, get their money out of the homeowner who may have already paid the general. Do you think, and here's my question, do you think that moving a bill like this to make the general responsible might reduce the
this problem?
Chair Holby, again, I'd want to take a look at what the numbers are in terms of the Contractors Board experience with how often that occurs. I believe it's an extremely small problem. Having said that, and again, we've from my earlier testimony, we've certainly fixed that on almost every home that we build in the residential building industry. So, having said that, I'm sure there are scenarios where a supplier probably has a relationship with a particular builder, friendly one, and you know, again, I don't want to speak to whether they do or don't know the financial solvability of the contractor they are trying to or they're giving their supplies to, but I just don't have the numbers to answer it. I'm sure if that does happen, then yes, this would potentially solve that problem.
And I guess to follow up with my own question here, it you know, from testimony we heard that there's about 1,000 complaints a year, which would indicate that, you know, it's not a exactly small problem on this having to pay twice because of the lien laws. So I guess, you know, my issue here is that if in fact, because I mean, we've also heard testimony that we don't have the ability to restrict construction contractor licenses from a builder who repeatedly declares bankruptcy and gets a new license and then repeats this scenario, and operating in the same community actually and getting their supplies from probably the same suppliers, and this goes on because the suppliers and the subcontractors know that they can recover their money from the homeowner, and you know, I just think that, you know, changing this lien law perhaps to put the general more at risk than and not the consumer may in effect cut down on this problem significantly.
Chairman, I'd just like to clarify. I believe that Craig Smith said there were about 1,000 claims filed per year. Of that, about 1 to 2% were lien related. So just 10 to 20. And I don't know how many of those involve suppliers that are, you know, handing supplies to someone they shouldn't be. Again, that would just be in those remodels under 50,000. And on a custom home where the job wasn't finished and the builder filed for bankruptcy. With regard to the bankruptcy concerns, those are major concerns, and I think we'll find that with legislation passed this session, that certainly we hope passes, we'll take care of a lot of that transfer or the ability of one company to kind of shut down, go bankrupt, and then open up something else without carrying that liability on to that next company. Certainly, we want to get rid of those folks as well.
Yeah. Thank you for that clarification in your answer. Further questions of the home builders and the associated general contractors? Thank you very much for your testimony. Anybody else that would like to testify? Mr. Smith, do you have anything you would like to add in regards to the last line of questioning?
Chair Halvey, thank you. Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. I'd just like to say I agree with the observations of both the AGC and home builders that this is a relatively small problem. It's been worked many times. I think that for new home construction, particularly speculation housing, that the problem, we don't see it at all. But I described a problem in Yamhill County that was huge. Representative Nelson talked about a problem that was up north in the Portland area that was huge. As I understand, that particular contractor, we're talking about $1 to $2 million worth of bankruptcy debt. Not all of it is paid twice situation, but the consumers, you know, the consumers have some loss. I just hope that if this isn't the right time and place for this concept, that we could have your approval to work with interested parties to try to move it forward to provide additional securities for consumers.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now that you're back up here, Mr. Smith, I have something I'd like to clarify. Mr. Berry and Ms. Adamson were talking about the situations that are covered by the early issue title insurance, and it's my understanding that this pay-twice problem doesn't exist in those particular transactions. Do you see the provisions of this bill as substituting for those protections or adding to them? And if they substitute, do they offer the same protection, at least the same protection that exists under the early issue title insurance?
Representative Holby and Representative Bonamici, I do see it as substituting or becoming, those provisions wouldn't be necessary. It would be impossible for consumers, I understand the way the bill is written, to be in a pay-twice situation, therefore wouldn't need those. So in my mind, it's a simplistic, more elegant solution, but some would argue it's too simplistic. I understand that. I just offer it for your consideration.
And
follow up, please.
And so, in your opinion, do the provisions of House Bill 2113 offer protections to the consumer that are at least as good as or better than what's provided under the early issue title insurance?
Chair Holby and Representative Bonamici, I only hesitate because I too am not a lawyer. I don't know that I am qualified to answer that question precisely. I think the solutions offered in the bill, just for consumers, as far as consumers are concerned, are an ultimate solution that would work very well for consumers. The downside to other parties in the equation, in the business equation, I may not be qualified to tell you about how bad that is.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, follow up?
Go ahead, please.
I just want to clarify that what I'm after here and would like to make sure that we're doing is if there are consumer protections that exist under existing law, that we're not substituting something that takes away the protection for a lower amount of protection. So just to clarify that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
I want to state how I see this and see it and get your reaction, see if you agree. Substituting this bill for the current protection, in my opinion, increases protection for the consumer in that it includes more people. And the only thing it does for the other people, the people who are now covered by that, is it changes who's responsible. It changes the responsible party from the insurance company to the actual people who contracted and supplied the general contractor.
Chair Holby and Representative Riley, I would not disagree.
Representative Galizio.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just an observation for what it's worth. I think policymakers too often wait for a crisis before they act. And I know if each one of us had five people in our districts who were stuck with a situation where they had paid $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 and had a reasonable expectation that the subs were being paid and then found that they were in this situation, I think they would be pretty angry if they saw the status quo of the law. So I would just hope that to the extent we can not substantially, you know, affect or impact negatively the concerns of the, you know, AGC and home builders, if we can do something vis-a-vis the homeowner, I think we should act. That would be my hope.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, a question. In this committee, we've also heard testimony in another bill on a vehicle to assist damaged consumers through an assistance fund, but not primarily for this purpose. In your view, would people that were damaged in this scenario be able to access that assistance fund?
Chair Holby,
if in fact we were to develop one?
Chair Holby, what I'm hearing your question is, if you created as an assembly a limited recovery fund or a limited assistance fund, would that assist folks in this dilemma? And if that, to the extent that's your question, the answer is yes.
Thank you.
It may be 25 cents on the dollar.
Further questions? Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know why this came to my mind, but when y'all had these hearings, your contractors' task force. Did you follow the same procedure that we do, so many hours for notification and blah, blah, blah?
Yes. Chair Halvey and Representative Nelson, while I wasn't intimately involved in setting up those meetings, I am familiar with the public meeting law, and I believe that all of those provisions were adhered to so that when there were public meetings, there was proper notice.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, please.
Would it be possible to get a list of those who came and testified?
Oh. Chair Halvey and Representative Nelson, absolutely.
Follow up. I think it's so important to know that what we're doing here has a vast arena, because individuals from the entire state came, showed their concerns, and so forth. And I think that will help us everywhere we need to go with this.
Very good.
Thank you. I think we can ask our committee administrator to produce that. I'm not sure Mr. Smith was actually running that task force as such. So, but if you are able to help out with that, we'd certainly appreciate it.
I'll work with Mr. Dixon to see through if that gets done.
Thank you. Further questions of Mr. Smith? Thank you very much for your second testimony on this today. Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify on this particular bill? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2113. With that, before I adjourn this meeting, I would like to establish a work group on this particular issue. So those that are interested, please contact my committee administrator, and we will endeavor to establish a group and set meeting times to talk about this particular bill a little bit further, and see if there's other ideas out there on how to make this a better bill for this committee to consider in going forward. Thank you. And with that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.